But as defined by our guest this morning, urban legends are those weird but credible stories that everyone tells us if they were true, although mostly they are fiction. Our guest this morning is Jan van Brunvand. Harold Brunvand. He is a professor of English folk. A professor of English specializing in folklore at the University of Utah. He has written four collections of these kind of urban legends. His books are The Vanishing Hitchhiker, The Choking Doberman, The Mexican Pet, and his most recent book is entitled Curses Broiled Again. It's published by W.W. Norton. The popularity of his work has led to four appearances on Late Night with David Letterman. He's been profiled in People. He also has a syndicated column, Urban Legends, that appears in many newspapers. He's published widely in all of the major folklore journals and is the author of the Standard Introduction, The Study of American Folklore, and also Readings in American Folklore. He has also served as editor of the prestigious Journal of American Folklore from 1976 until 1980, and he makes his home in Salt Lake City, Utah. As we talk about urban legends this morning and hear some of the stories in his most recent collection, we hope that you will call, and perhaps there are some folks out there who have some urban legends of their own that they would like to pass on, stories that they have heard, whether they believe them to be true or not. You might like to share them with other people who are listening and with our guest, Professor Brunvand. If you'd like to call in, please do give us a call. The local number here is 333-9455, and we have a toll-free line, so you can call in no matter where you are, and that number is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Professor Brunvand, hello.
Hello. Your voice suddenly got much softer when you switched me on. I don't know if you can turn it up or not.
I think we can. My director says he can a little bit.
Okay, fine.
Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, very good.
Thanks
well,
for the nice introduction.
I enjoyed your book very much. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
I think maybe the best way to start out introducing people to the topic is to tell one of the stories, and perhaps you could tell us about Curses Broiled Again, which I guess there are a couple of versions of this, but they all involve a woman who was obsessed with getting a tan.
Right. The trouble with asking a folklorist to tell a story is that the folklorist always knows so many versions that he gets sidetracked with all the variations, so I try to discipline myself and be a better storyteller. The way I first heard it, a colleague came into my office and said he had been teaching summer school up in South Dakota, and he'd heard this wild story about a young lady who was going to be a bridesmaid the very next week and just didn't have any kind of a suntan at all. This was late summer, and she thought that if she could get into the tanning salon for a few hours a day, she could get a good tan. But they wouldn't allow her to do that. They only allowed 30 minutes a day. So she went around to every tanning salon in town and got her 30 minutes here and her 30 minutes there. And not only did she get a good tan, she also got a terrible smell. The story that was going around was that she started to smell like rotting meat or something worse, you know. Mm-hmm. And so eventually she went to the doctor and told him what was happening, and he examined her and questioned her and shook his head sadly and said, "Young lady, I'm sorry to say you have microwaved your insides. You are cooked from the inside out and have only a short time to live." The funny thing was that not only had my colleague heard another version of it, she stayed lying on one side too long and cooked only one arm, and it had to be amputated. I don't know why I'm laughing, because it's a horrible story. But in the course of the day and on in the week and in the weeks to follow, I kept hearing more and more versions of that. Sometimes she was going to Hawaii and wanted a tan before getting on the beach. Sometimes she was a cheerleader. Sometimes it was very specific microwaves coming out of those lamps that only cooked her ovaries, and she would never be able to have children, and on it goes. So I decided this was an urban legend.
Mm-hmm. Now, this one of the things that this story illustrates is the tremendous legs these stories have, because people really seem to enjoy telling them, whether they believe that they are true or they just think it's kind of a strange, believe it or not, sort of story. These things really get around.
They certainly do. I get a great deal of mail now as a result of the books and the newspaper column and programs like this as well. And uh, I've I've concluded that people are transmitting these stories not only in the age-old method of folklore, face-to-face verbal retellings, but also in letters, long-distance telephone, fax machines, computer bulletin boards, and, of course, people travel a lot nowadays. So as they're traveling, they tell them and hear them, and they really do spread remarkably quickly and develop many variations. So it's a very interesting area of folklore to study because it's happening right now. It's really living folklore.
Yeah. I have to tell you, I was reminded of the fact that a couple of years ago on this program, we were doing a show with a veterinarian, and it's a fellow who's been doing the show for many years, and a couple times a year he comes in, we talk about taking care of your pets.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a caller call in and tell the story that is, as I understand it, it's the Mexican pet.
Yeah, it was the...
The people go, they're on vacation, they adopt a cute little stray dog, they bring it home, they take it to the vet, and find out that it's a giant rat.
Had the vet heard the story before?
Well, he didn't say that he had, and he was very nice. And I think basically he tried to say he thought it would be unlikely that someone would mistake a rat for a dog.
Yeah.
But I was sitting there thinking, this is an urban folktale, and I've heard this story before.
Absolutely.
I was pleased and kind of amazed.
Yeah, what's happened in that story is that nowadays it's seldom any longer told as people coming back from Mexico with a little presumed chihuahua and taken to the vet, but it has turned into a story that people are telling at various cities that are on seacoast. I've heard it from Baltimore, from New York, from Miami, from San Francisco, etc. People are strolling along the harbor and pick up a little animal that they assume is a stray dog and then eventually take it to their vet. Sometimes it has fought with their pets at home and they need treatment. Sometimes they just want shots. I even got to the point once, and of course he tells them it's a rat off a banana boat or something. I got to the point once where I read an article somebody sent me from the Baltimore Sun that their rumor control center, which they have in Baltimore, to field all kinds of questions about toxic spills or... racial-related incidents. If there are rumors flying around, people want to know they can call. People were calling and asking about this rat story. And so I called them long distance and asked them for some details, and they were just baffled by where this thing had come from. So I tried to help them out.
What is it? We'll tell some other stories.
Sure.
And there, when you ask this question, why do people tell them? Obviously, the reason may be slightly different from one story to another. And they may, I think they do say some interesting things about us and how we feel about the world and our contemporary culture. But on a basic sort of a level, why do you think people pass these stories around so readily? Why do they like to tell them to each other?
Well, I think the most basic level is just the love of a good story, the power of the narrative, the focus of some attention on yourself as one who knows the latest bit of news that's going around. I feel that they are simpler, less stressful to tell than jokes, because when you tell a joke, you have to get the timing and the punchline and maybe even dialect just right. And a lot of people will kind of demur and say, oh, I really can't tell that joke, or stop me if you've heard this, and so on. But with these, there's no sense that they're performing something dramatic, though they are, with gestures and raised eyebrows and so on. And there's a little more sense that it's just a bit of news. So I think that's the primary motive. I like to say that the truth never stands in the way of a good story.
Yeah.
And then there's the underlying message or meaning, which is sometimes very overt, something like keep your eyes on your kids while you're shopping, because I heard this story about an attempted abduction at the shopping mall where they dyed the child's hair and changed her clothes and tried to smuggle her out, and it underscores a lesson, or check the back seat of your car, and then another story is told to illustrate that.
Yeah. They do, most of them, many of them do seem to have this strong element it's a cautionary tale.
That's right. And even though something like Curses Broiled Again cautions against the wrong thing, there are no microwaves, you're not going to cook your insides, there is certainly a danger of overexposure to these ultraviolet rays, severe sunburn, possible skin cancer. And so there's a kind of a quasi-warning there, even though it's against the wrong thing.
Yeah. It's interesting that we have sort of two kinds of stories in the way of cautionary tales that seem to tap into things that we are afraid of. And some of them, and maybe we can tell some examples of each category, some of them show that we are afraid of you know, sort of things that go bump in the night, mm-hmm. like probably people have always been afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
And also some of them show that we are, and curses brawled again, I think is an example of this kind of story, that we don't really trust modern technology very mm-hmm. much.
Yeah.
And that you've got to watch out or it's going to get you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the classic example of the sort of scare story that you alluded to first, I would say, is The Hook, which has been a favorite of teenagers for generations and has localized almost every community. The kids that are parked on Lover's Lane one night listening to the radio, suddenly the music is interrupted by an announcement that some maniac has escaped from a local asylum. He has a hook in place of a hand. People should be on the lookout. And the girl turns to her date and says, I'm nervous. Take me home. Let's get out of here. And the guy, somewhat chagrined at this, roars out of the parking place, spins the tires, drives to her home. I always think this is the unrealistic part. He politely gets out and walks around the car to open the door for her and finds this hook dangling from the door handle on her side. And, you know, kids will talk about Hook Man's Lane in some areas, or they'll just swear here in Salt Lake, for example, that it happened in Memory Grove, a favorite parking place, park in the center of the city. And they don't really question the logic of it, that this dangerous person would be given a hook, that he would try to open the door with a hook hand, that he would be lurking there just as the announcement is made, and so on. So that's definitely a scare story, and kind of a warning. You know, it's kind of the parent standard warning. Now, don't stay out too late and be careful.
Yeah. And that also seems to point to one of the hallmarks of these stories, and that is that under the force of logic and to the cold light of reason, they tend to break down because you start asking, now, wait a minute.
Sure.
You look at various parts of it and say, but this really doesn't make sense. But somehow people don't, you know, they prefer not to look at it in the cold light of reason. They like to, they just sort of relish in the improbability of it.
Yeah, but on the other hand, this is not a story about a little green man from Mars or a UFO or the Bermuda Triangle or anything that requires a belief in the ESP or the supernatural. In fact, you'll find this story especially prominent near communities where there is an asylum and where there are other rumors and legends about such a place. And so it does, you know, seem to make sense. And most of us, I also have another thing to add here.
Mm-hmm.
Here we hear these attributed to what I call a FOAF, F-O-A-F, which stands for friend of a friend. They know this person who knows someone else who was the participant, and they've heard it on that same authority. And I used to try to track down the FOAFs, but it got to be such an endless quest that instead I started just collecting the variations and assumed that the FOAF always knows another FOAF.
Yeah. Our guest this morning, just for people who have just tuned in, is Jan Harald Brunvand. He's professor of English at the University of Utah. His specialty is folklore, and a particular kind of folklore, that is the urban legend. He has written 4 books that are collections of these stories, and we're talking about some of the stories that are in his most recent book, which is entitled Curses Broiled Again. If you have questions or you want to share a story with us, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You have a story in the book which you call The Graveyard Wager.
Mm-hmm.
That is interesting because it apparently is a version of a kind of story that people have been telling maybe forever, or at least for a long, long time. The story goes something like this. We have some young girls at a slumber party, and as happens when people get together in these circumstances, they start telling scary stories, and they talk about the fact that someone has just recently died and been buried, and there are stories about how if you go to the cemetery where the person is buried, you will hear scratching, or someone heard scratching as if the person had been buried alive. So they're dares, and someone dares one of the party to go to the cemetery, to the grave. But they say, now, you have to do something to prove that you really went there. What we want you to do is, when you go there, is stick a stick. Just put a stick in the ground by the grave, so then we'll know that you were there. So the person goes off to do this, and some time goes by and doesn't come back. And all night goes by and she doesn't come back. And so they go to the cemetery the next day and find the little girl, or the teenage girl, dead by the grave. And what has happened is that in her haste to do this deed and get away, she has driven the stick through her skirt and has staked herself to the ground. However, when she gets up to go away, she fears that the dead person has grabbed her and she dies of fright.
You know, this gives me the chills just to hear you talking.
Oh, thank you. And what's wonderful about that story is apparently that people have been telling those kind of grabbed by the corpse story for a long, long time, and so it's a contemporary version of a very old story.
Exactly. I started writing occasional columns about older stories, very much older stories that have a continual life as so-called news stories, when some readers of my column wrote to me and said, why don't you do rural legends instead of just urban legends? And this one's a folklorist's delight because what flashes into our mind right away is an index number for it in the standard reference work on European folktales. I couldn't give you the number off the top of my head, but I just looked it up as you were telling, 1676B, Clothing Caught in Graveyard. What this means is that folklorists have cataloged so many versions of this so far back that we recognize it as a floating tale, and to have it pop up as a slumber party story from, I think that was from the Midwest that somebody sent me that.
I think so, too, that it was like possibly Indiana.
I think it was, yeah, and it was quite remarkable to get that. Then I looked in the file on that story, and I also had a letter from a professor at a university in South Africa. His version of it was that were medical students who were wearing their white lab coats, and they had a bet at dinner that one of them would dare to go into the morgue where there was a corpse on the slab and plunge a knife into it to prove that he had gone in the middle of the night. And the same thing happens. He plunges it through the edge of his lab coat, and he feels it tugging and screams and thinks he's being pulled back by the dead person. In older versions, it was sometimes a soldier with his sword who's going to drive it into the ground, and it gets the skirt of a sort of overcoat he's wearing. So it's a very old story, and it's interesting to have this modern version of it going around.
Do you find it, as you hear new urban legends, that you see the same thing, that these are somehow contemporary versions of old folk tales?
Yeah, they don't have to be that old, though, but that very frequently happens. It's come to the point where I always put new in quotation marks now when I'm describing them, either with an inflection or literally on the page. So I'll say something like, new urban legends, quotes, and then reveal that many of them are older. Let me give you a good example, which sounds very modern and up-to-date. It's a story about the very successful company Mrs. Fields Cookies that has all these outlets and shopping malls where they bake them fresh, and who can resist the smell of those warm cookies? And so somebody supposedly calls the headquarters of the company and asks if they could have the recipe for the chocolate chip cookies, and supposedly are told they are welcome to it for a charge of $2.50. So they put this on their credit card, giving the number over the phone, and when it comes through the mail, they're horrified to see that it's $250. So what you get then is a photocopied, typed up and photocopied version of the recipe, which is not anything, has no connection to Mrs. Fields Company at all. It's just a recipe that people have. Plus this little story, and the idea is that in revenge, the woman is sending this out to her friends, putting it in the newspaper, giving it out at her bridge club, putting it in her Christmas card. I've got dozens and dozens of these flyers typed by different people, little variations on the story. Well, what this is an updated version of an older story called Red Velvet Cake, which used to be told in the Waldorf Astoria restaurant in the hotel in New York City. The recipe was for a bright red cake. The charge was $50 instead of $2.50. There was no credit card involved. They just asked for the recipe, and the bill was added, or the charge was added to their bill when it came from the kitchen. And this, too, was duplicated and passed around. Oh, in the 50s, it was a popular story, and a lot of people still have the recipes, I'm sure, in their recipe files and tell the story and make the cake. I checked with the Waldorf. No such thing ever happened there. Mm.
We have a couple of callers here to talk with.
Okay.
Let's do that. We'll go first to our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the hook story. I think I can explain why the young man seemed so courteous and got out and opened the door. I first heard that story about 1947, and that's when males did get out of the car and go around and open the door.
Well, that makes some sense. I was pretty young then, but I think I was a polite young man. Yeah, the other reason I would give is that he absolutely has to, or the story
wouldn't
end right.
Of course he has to make the story good, but I was in Texas, and
yeah,
we heard this story, and it was probably a slumber party, and I was 15 or 16, and we were absolutely sure it had happened to somebody we knew. What fascinates me is not only did these stories get all over the country,
yeah,
but that story's lasted 50 years.
Have you been telling it all that time, or did
no,
you change your mind again?
No. Ever since I read your book, I said, now I know. I tell people, now I know what these things are.
Yeah, it's a kind of a nostalgia thing. That's one thing that motivated me. I was brought up in Michigan and in Lansing, and lived not far from the Oldsmobile factory. And the first urban legend I remember hearing was the one about the death car, the car with the smell of death in the upholstery that was somewhere in a lot for $50. And we were all sure we could stand that smell if we could only find that car.
Well, thanks very much. I've enjoyed listening to you and reading your books.
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. Other calls are welcome. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. That story about the bargain sports car, and it also makes me think that there are at least a few of these stories that have some element of wish fulfillment. For example, there's also another story that you tell in the book concerning a woman who is, maybe she's out shopping. She needs to use the restroom, and she goes into a couple of stores, and they don't have one. And so the next place she comes to is a funeral home. And so she creeps in there and uses the restroom and then comes through the viewing room, which is deserted. However, there is a coffin there on display, which is open up, and there's a person in there. And she feels kind of bad about, you know, going through this room here where the person is on display. So to make herself feel a little bit better, she goes over to the guest book and signs it. Sometime later, a letter arrives from an attorney saying that this woman has inherited $10,000 from the deceased person who put in their will. Apparently, they were very disliked, who put in their will, if anybody comes to my funeral, they can have this money.
Yeah.
So, and it's sort of like the bargain sports car with the smell of death, or...
Yeah, it's wishful thinking.
Yeah.
It also does illustrate human nature, the wish to sort of do the right thing, you know, and to and then, you know, the real human needs to try to find a restroom. This is often told in New York City, and I don't quite know where you would go except back to your hotel or something, in some of those midtown busy streets. Actually, the editor of my book, one day on her lunch break, walked down, and this was told as a specific New York City story, walked down a couple of blocks that were named to see if there was a funeral home there and to see if she could check on it, but wasn't able to pin it down any further than somewhere in this neighborhood. Yeah, and that's certainly true of the cheap car stories. There are other cheap car stories that lead up to other conclusions besides the death car. For example, there's a very popular one of somebody who answers an ad for, I usually call it, the $75 Porsche, finds it to be a beautiful car, and the price is so low, he just can't believe it, you know, and writes the check, buys the car, then asks the woman why she's selling it. That's the right order to do these things in. And she smiles and says, well, my husband about 2 weeks ago ran off with his secretary. He just called home and asked me to sell the car and send him the money. So she sells it for $75.
Mm-hmm. I'm keeping people waiting. I just love these stories.
Uh-huh.
There are some that that have this kind of revenge motive. This is like the story of the couple who breaks up. The woman has a key to the man's apartment, and they break up over the phone. And the man says, "Look, this is just not going to work. I don't want to see you again. I'm going out of town. Would you please go to my apartment, get your stuff, and leave the key?" So they hang up. The guy goes out of town. The woman goes to the apartment. She's gathering up her things. She's steamed. She says, "Well, I'm going to fix this guy." So she picks up his telephone, dials time and temperature in Tokyo, and leaves the phone off the hook. And when the man comes back, he's got a $5,000 phone bill because it's been sitting off the hook for 2 weeks.
Serves the rascal right.
That's right. That's right.
And this is actually told in Europe. I had a version from London in which they dialed what they called the New York City speaking clock, which I thought was a nice term for it. I'm not sure how you dial time and temperature in Tokyo, or whether your phone would keep on receiving for weeks and weeks, you know, or it seems to me it would sort of go off after a while.
This though makes me think that this is a story that has been told enough that one day someone really will do it.
It's possible. In fact, I've run into some incidents where people have acted out the what I would call the fantasy of a legend. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, back to the phones here. We'll go first to line number one. Hello.
I have heard several times, I don't know whether you've covered this yet or not, about the family that was, say, vacationing in Canada, and the old grandmother died, and it was wintertime, and they put her in a casket on top of the car, went into the restaurant to eat on the way back, and somebody stole their car, complete with the container on top of the car containing grandmother, and they never found her again. You've heard that, haven't you?
You bet. Yeah, that's the one folklorists call the runaway grandmother. I don't know. She doesn't really run away, but that's what the first person who collected it called it. It's often set in Mexico, and the premise is that since they don't speak Spanish and they're very distressed, of course, they just want to go home and have a mortician at home take care of it. So they've been camping, and they put her in a sleeping bag or a tarp or something, and then the same thing happens. They stop to eat, and the car is stolen. I have heard it as a Canadian story with a canoe on the roof, but I don't believe I've heard it before where it was literally a casket on the roof.
Well, I think that some kind of container.
Sure. You know, it's really a parallel in a way to the story that I call the dead cat in the package, the person who's trying to get rid of the body of their pet cat that has died because she lives in an apartment and has no place to dispose of it, and she is going to meet a friend from the suburbs. She calls and arranges this in a downtown department store, and the friend will take the package with the cat in it and bury it in her garden. And then during the morning while she's downtown waiting for the friend, the package is stolen from her. She just looks the other way and someone lifts it. And then later she sees this little old lady passed out on the sidewalk. People are all standing around looking at her, and next to her is the cat package open. So you get that corpse unwittingly stolen. In the grandmother story, you never get to see the thieves. You just imagine their amazement when they see what they've got on the roof.
One of my youngsters, as a hobby, used to take cockleburrs each fall, put them in a cotton-lined little pill box, and take them to school to show the youngsters the porcupine eggs.
That's a prank. That's a wonderful prank. Sort of folk Velcro, too, isn't it?
Yes.
I like that.
Thanks. Well,
thank you for the call.
For calling.
We will talk to a couple of other people in just a minute. Our guest this morning is Jan Harald Brunvand. He's a folklorist at University of Utah and a specialist in the area of the urban legend. He has written four books, which are collections of these stories. His newest book is entitled Curses Broiled Again. It's published by W.W. Norton. We'll talk some more in just a moment. We do have another caller here waiting on line number two. We'll talk with them next. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first contemporary legend that I heard, I've always called the Kentucky Fried Rat, and this is something I'm sure a lot of people have heard. It goes like, the version I heard was, there's a couple teenagers out on a date, and it's dark, okay, and they pull through some sort of chicken place, all right, into the drive-up window or something, and because they're hungry, and they get some chicken, and then they drive off, and it's dark, right, and they're eating away, and the girl says, boy, this tastes really weird, you know, and I'm synopsizing very briefly, but so they turn on a light and, oh my God, it's a fried rat instead of a chicken leg.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the end exactly, but aside from curiosity about what the point of the story is at the end, which I cannot remember so long ago, is what do you think the genesis of that sort of story is?
Yeah, well, the end is usually that they sue the company and they settle out of court usually for some tremendous amount of money, and so it's like the mouse and the Coke stories or the other
right.
Contaminated. There are a whole lot of contaminated food stories. I've gotten, so I call that the batter fried rat to try to sound a little less like I'm putting the blame on a particular company, though we all know the popular company. You're absolutely right about the low light, because that's essential to the story, that she's eating before she sees what she's got. Sometimes they're at a drive-in movie. Sometimes they're watching TV with the lights low. Sometimes they're in front of the fireplace, a romantic interlude. Sometimes the wife has brought home the chicken and is serving it to her husband by candlelight to sort of mask the fact that she didn't get around to cooking at the time. There's so many versions of that. I think it's a story that reflects people's concern about fast foods, and a little bit of guilt that instead of home cooking, we're going out for things. And also the coating, the herbs and spices we hear about, you know, is that to mask something? Is that to hide something? And there's always the possibility in our minds that under that coating might be the wrong thing, although I think it's extremely unlikely, and I have absolutely no kind of evidence that anything like this ever happened. It also illustrates the difference between a rumor and a legend. If someone just says, I hear that there are worms in the burgers at such and such a place, that's just a rumor. It doesn't really have a story. But as this food contamination topic gets talked about, it develops a story. You've got them driving in, picking it up, parking somewhere to eat it, the conversation, turning on the lights, the aftermath. It becomes a whole little literary gem, in a way. Oral literature, though.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I remember it so well that you know, when I heard this, and I've heard about the, you know, well, urban legends. I think contemporary legends is more phrase I would use, but
some other folklore.
Yeah, whatever. But it struck home. Then, you know, years later, I went, "Wow, that's I heard one of those."
Yeah. I was in New Zealand about a year ago, and they have a lot of the American fast food places there. And somebody was telling me about a New Zealander who knew someone who knew someone who was in a Kentucky Fried place waiting for his order, and supposedly somebody came in with a dead possum by the tail. This is an Australian possum that has been introduced, I think accidentally, in New Zealand, and has become really, has proliferated and become a nuisance. They slap it down on the counter, supposedly, and say to the manager, "And this is the last one I'm bringing in until you pay me for all the others." It would just be absolutely the worst thing in the world for a New Zealander to think that there was possum meat in their chicken, and that was the local version of it.
Listen, this is really off the subject, but just 10 seconds. I've been fascinated by New Zealand. Just a 10-second synopsis. Did you like the place?
It's a wonderfully friendly country, and I loved it. They're very nice people and beautiful scenery.
I really want to go there. Well, anyway, thanks a lot.
Another time we can talk about New Zealand.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you for the call. Other calls are welcome. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Do people tell these stories everywhere?
They seem to. I'm getting more and more of a handle on that. In the first place, there are folklorists who are starting to study them and publish them. Well, let's see. The latest book I got was from Finland, and guess what? The title is The Runaway Grandmother, or The Grandmother Lost on Vacation. I can't read Finnish, but I could read the cartoon illustration on the cover and the German summary that came with it. There are folklorists working on these in Scandinavia. They're very common there. There have been collections in England. There was one even some years before my first book. Also, a couple of my books have been translated. The Vanishing Hitchhiker was translated into Japanese recently, and I've been getting letters from Japan containing legends. The Mexican Pet was translated into Italian, and the translator wrote a preface summarizing some Italian legends that I didn't have in the book. I'm not sure about the entire world, but certainly these are part of contemporary experience to hear and repeat and embellish these stories.
Yeah. As various folklorists have tried to trace these tales back to their point of origin, I wonder, are there cases where some of these things have been based on some real event, but it has grown in the telling?
Yes, but rarely. Hmm. Most folklorists would probably say, if they're working in this area, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not really looking for the origin. I'm looking for the meaning and the purpose of the stories. But I'm interested in any aspect that I can unearth, and in only a few instances have I got back to what I feel sure is the source. It seems to me that the source, in a lot of cases, is just the human mind playing around with possibilities. What if, and then each person repeating something adds something to it, or recycling an older legend. Here's a good example of one that springs from an event. I kept hearing a story attributed to different university campuses, friend of a friend sort of thing. A young man comes into a math exam late, finds three problems written on the board, sits down to do them, and after a great deal of difficulty with the last problem, gets all three solved, turns in his work, and leaves. Supposedly later in the evening, the professor calls him in great excitement, said, "I was just going through the papers, and that third problem I had put on the board just as an example before class, you were late and didn't hear the announcement. That was an unsolvable problem that even Einstein was baffled by. I just told the class, this won't be on your exam, and you solved it,
Mm-hmm.
And when I wrote something about that, I started hearing from math teachers who referred me to an eminent mathematician at Stanford University named George Danzig, who had a similar experience. And to make a long story short, he was a first-year graduate student at Berkeley. It was a statistics class. There were not three problems, but two, both previously unsolved. He thought they were homework, took them home, and with great effort solved them. And his teacher turned them in, and later his teacher informed him what he had done. And actually, he published both of them eventually, and they sort of became the first stepping stone in his career. What happened was that Professor Danzig told this story to the man he was sitting next to on an airplane one time, who turned out to be Reverend Robert Schuller of the Crystal Cathedral in Southern California, the Hour of Power Run.
Oh, yes.
And Schuller garbled it somewhat and told it, and of course he has an enormous audience. It got published in Schuller's autobiography, it got reprinted in various newsletters, and then people started to adapt it to fit their understanding of what must have happened. Without any reference to Schuller or Danzig, it just becomes, there is this student who.
Yeah,
it's kind of a long-winded example, but it's so rare and unusual that I'm quite pleased that I came to an origin of that one.
That's
anyway.
Neat. And also, you do have a section in the book that has academic legends, and so colleges certainly have theirs, and that's
one.
That's
another thing I'm finding out more and more, that each profession and occupation and area of life seems to have its distinctive legends, and some of them would need a lot of footnoting and explanation, especially some of the medical and technical ones. I love the academic ones because that's the world I live in most of the time.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some more callers. We'll go to line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm really enjoying the show. I heard a version of the Cat in the Bag that was extended a little bit from what you said, which was that when the ambulance arrived on the scene to take the woman away, one of the passersby very solicitously gave the bag to the medic who took it in the ambulance. So one had the idea that when she was revived, the first thing she would see would be this bag again.
Well, there are versions in which you don't even need to imagine it, because sometimes she has gone into a restaurant and the owner of the dead cat has seen her take it out of her car, and she watches to see what will happen. And when the woman reaches, she orders a cup of coffee, and then she reaches into the bag and feels this dead cat. She faints, and then the paramedics come. And there are stories in which the waitress, as the woman is being put on the stretcher and they're carrying her away, notices the bag and says, "Oh, she forgot her package," and puts it on her stomach. And just then, the woman comes to, looks into the bag, screams, and faints a second time. So you're right on. That's another common variation of that story.
But this story was told to me by my wife as having been told to her by a friend of hers as having actually occurred in her family. But you're saying so when I heard it on the radio, I was just, I was really surprised because I had
the
real story.
I don't want to call anyone a liar. I'm sure she heard it.
Uh-huh.
Stood it to be something that had happened to the person that told her. But I will wager in anything that's legal in our two states that you will find that this is a friend of a friend tradition that's been passed on. For example, it's told here in Salt Lake City. People will talk about the specific store in the mall where the woman was going, and she had a plastic bag in the car from that store with something she was going to exchange. She accidentally hit a cat on a snowy street, took out the contents of the bag, put the cat in. They go through all these details as if it happened right here just last week, and yet this story has been around. Well, I've traced versions of the Cat in the Bag to about the turn of the century.
Well, that's fascinating, because I heard it as if it had happened in Marketplace here in Champaign.
Terrific.
Okay, well, thanks. It's really
thank
a good
you.
Show.
Thank you. On to another caller here. We'll go to the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I want to tell a story that's about me. I know it's true, but it's also about doing folklore and legends.
Let's hear it.
I'm an anthropologist. I worked with an Indian community down in southern Mexico. There was one guy I was always trying to get hold of, and he was slippery. He didn't really want to talk. And the one occasion in which I got him with a bunch of other people around, he's going to have to talk to me, he started telling a story of the old times. And it was just getting started in the story when I recognized an old folk tale that my grandfather had told me. It was the story of why dogs sniff each other's tails.
Uh-huh.
And that's a nice old story. And I felt that I'd done enough. I've identified the element. Here he's telling sniff tail story. Unfortunately, that meant that I turned off my memory. What he was doing as a means of making this story come out interesting in local terms, he was saying, well, the dogs were being used to carry messages, and the only way you could find out whether a dog was carrying a message was have another dog find out. And the message used to go from the king of this place to the man who was the chief man here. And he gave a whole list of things, which the next day or so I started, wait a minute, what did he say?
Uh-huh.
And what I came up with was the bare facts I could remember went along with the real honest-to-gosh facts of where particular groups had allied themselves against the Spanish in the time of the conquest. And I left all that stuff out because I knew the story.
Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting. How long ago was this?
Actually, this happened 30 years ago.
Yeah, I wonder if you've changed your fieldwork techniques or your attitude when you collect after that experience.
I changed my fieldwork techniques and my attitude.
I've always heard that the dogs had a license of some kind given by the creator, and one of them lost it, and they're always looking for it, and the only place they can think of to hide it is under the tail.
Yes, and my grandfather's version really had to do with a big meeting of all the dogs there were, and being polite. They didn't take their tails into the meeting room. They hung them up. And there was a fire. And they all ran out grabbing any tail they could to protect them.
Oh, and then they've had the wrong ones ever since.
And they've been looking for their own.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, I have a principle in studying these modern stories. I'm not in far remote areas talking to native peoples or alien cultures or anything like that. I'm just talking to my students, my friends, and so on. But I try. It may not be evident in this eager early morning interview when I'm anticipating everybody's story, but I try never to say I've heard it before. Have you heard the one about? I just say, no. How does it go? Tell me. And there's often it's some little variation that I didn't expect.
But, of course, when I was doing this, I hadn't had any training in folklore
sure.
at all. Of course, the interest is in the details that vary.
Sure. That's a good example. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Bye.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest this morning on Focus is Jan Harald Brunvand. He's a professor of English at the University of Utah. He specializes in folklore and has collected a great many urban legends in four books that he has written. His newest book, Curses Broiled Again. He also publishes a syndicated column, which appears in many newspapers, and that always generates a great volume of letters with people writing him with stories that they have heard. Well, I think we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that some of these stories tap into our various sorts of fears. Some of them are fears of technology. Some of them may be fears of goblins and monsters that are really very old. There's a story that has been very persistent that has to do with a very contemporary fear, and that is AIDS. This is the story of AIDS Mary, which has been told a great deal, apparently. This is the story of supposedly a man goes out to a nightclub, meets a woman. They go back to his apartment. They make love. In the morning, he wakes up. She's gone and finds scrawled on the mirror in the bathroom something like, "Welcome to the world of AIDS."
Mm-hmm. I communicated that as soon as I heard it. I was writing to a fellow folklorist in Stockholm, and I just added that into the letter. Here's one I've just heard. It's got to be an urban legend. He wrote right back and said, the way I've heard it over here, she writes, "Welcome to the AIDS Club." Same conclusion. Then he goes to the doctor and finds that he's got the AIDS virus, and he goes to the police and finds that they've been trying to catch this woman, whom I dub AIDS Mary in sort of memory of Typhoid Mary. As a folklorist, the first thing that struck me when I started hearing that story was that I've encountered that handwriting on the wall, that sort of morning after shock, lurid, bright red message in an earlier legend, namely the one in which it's another slumber party story, in which the girls at a slumber party, they fall asleep. That's the unbelievable part. And during the night, the girl at whose home they're having the party wakes up a couple of times. There's some sort of disturbance, but her hand is over the side of the bed, and the dog licks it. And usually she wakes up three times, because things happen in threes in these kinds of traditions. And each time the dog licks her hand. And in the morning she wakes up and sees that all her little friends have been murdered. They're all lying around with their throats slashed and so on. She runs screaming out of the room into the bathroom. And there is the dog also slain and written in blood on the wall of the bathroom. It says, "People can lick too." Or humans can lick too. And so that lipstick message, the shocking revelation of what's happened, is really a recycled theme from an earlier legend.
Well, it also makes you, as you mentioned in the book, it makes you think about the biblical story
the
writing on the wall.
Writing on the wall a long time ago.
That's right. It's some things about this story, though, that's one element that seems to persist, the writing on the wall. But it's also interesting that the agent of transmission is a woman. And from what we seem to be told by medical people, this is a very unlikely thing to happen. And yet, it's always the woman. It's always one contact.
Yeah, it's a very unlikely scenario to get AIDS in one such contact. And I call the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta just to ask about that. I just said I was writing a newspaper column. I didn't mention that I was a folklorist. And then after sort of asking straight factual questions about how common is this, or how likely is this, or what are the ways that AIDS is transmitted more commonly, I said, "What about this story I've heard?" And I told the story, and the man at the other end, sort of at the AIDS desk, I guess, said, "Oh, well, that we've heard that many times. It's merely an urban legend," which I thought was a wonderful adoption of this term as a sort of generic term. Well, I've also heard it told by men coming back from conventions who will tell their wives this is something they heard about another guy at the convention. They don't know who it is, but they heard it from someone.
Uh-huh.
So it carries all kinds of warnings, and it continues to be quite a popular story.
Yeah. Let's talk with some other people here. Let's go to line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I got in just in time to hear the end of the cat in the bag thing. So you may have already talked about this story, but it's a cat story, sort of, that I heard years ago and thought it was really gross and couldn't believe it really happened. Is this in your book, the one with the kitten that they put in the microwave to dry it off?
Oh, that's in the first book, yeah.
Okay.
How come they put it in the microwave? What's your version?
That it was wet, and they put it in the microwave to dry it off is what I heard.
Just like that. Sometimes that's told as if it's a little child is sprinkling the lawn, got the cat wet, and they've seen mommy, reheat leftovers, so they think that's the way to dry the kitty,
uh-huh.
So you get the childish misunderstanding. Sometimes it's told, and it's usually a poodle in this version, I call the story Hot Dog then.
Uh-huh.
The woman has a pet toy poodle, and she's always left her oven door open and turned it up just a tad and put the poodle, after giving it its daily, or I guess weekly bath, on a towel on the open door to dry in the nice warm heat, and then someone gives her a microwave oven for Christmas. So again, it's a misunderstanding
uh-huh.
how it works. Other people would tell me, well, didn't you see the movie Gremlins, where they do put a little gremlin in the microwave? And I said, well, the story was
no.
first, and it's an awful enough story. I don't want to see the movie if that's what they do.
No, I thought that was probably an apocryphal story.
Yeah, I consider it to be so. However, I have read about cruelty to animal cases that were brought to appeal. So you have the appeals records you can look up where people, I would have to say, demented or sometimes under the influence of drugs or something, have on a dare done this to animals. But again, it's after the story. It's long after the story was circulating, and it was strictly an apocryphal story. So there's a kind of unfortunate level at which sometimes bad people do bad things, I guess mm-hmm. we'd have to say.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. There is just sort of to round out here, because we're unfortunately going to have to stop.
Yeah, I have to go to class. Would you believe
it? What an annoying thing to have to do, isn't it?
Well, it's actually a nice break. Today we're talking about open air folk museums, and I'm showing some slides of folk museums in Europe and in this country. Mm-hmm. So it's a different sort of topic from this.
Just one quick story sure. That sort of the flips or related to the dead pet story is the hairdryer.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. People whose big German Shepherd drags home a dead rabbit, which they recognize as the neighbor's pet of many years, and they wash it and blow dry it and slip it back into its cage or its hutch, only to learn later that the neighbor's pet had died. It had been buried in the backyard, and as the neighbor puts it, it looks like some weirdo has dug up our bunny and washed it and sneaked it back in the cage. Who would do such a thing?
And there are a lot of versions also stories like deceased pet being shipped somewhere and someone like in the airlines sees the dead pet and they think, oh my gosh, we've killed it. And so they go out and get a matching live pet and a live pet arrives when someone was expecting the dead pet.
And again, you get the owner screaming in shock
yes.
or fainting and
yes.
saying, but we were shipping our dead pet home and what's happened? It's come back to life. I actually found in an article about Colonel Oliver North's going in the lecture circuit that's one of the favorite jokes he likes to start his speeches with, and the one about the air-shipped dead pet, and apparently the moral he draws from it is sometimes trying harder doesn't please anyone, or
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Well, on that note, we will close. It's been a lot of fun talking with you, and I enjoyed the book. Our guest, Jan Harald Brunvand, professor of English at the University of Utah. He has four books that are collections of these kinds of stories. The most recent one is Curses Broiled Again, published by W.W. Norton. His other books are The Vanishing Hitchhiker, The Choking Doberman, and The Mexican Pet.